She's deconstructing psychiatry. Local filmmaker Cindy Lou Griffith has been exploring the role of psychiatry in the transgression of human rights and patients' rights to say no ever since her father was incarcerated at Riverview Psychiatric Hospital. Cindy Lou joins us in studio along with an interviewee from one of her films, Irit Shimrat. She is the editor of the West Coast Mental Health Network Bulletin and the author of Call Me Crazy, Stories from the Mad Movement. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
Our pleasure.
So first off, Cindy Lou, one of your films is called Song for My Father, and it's about your own response to his psychiatric incarceration. Can you just tell us a bit about what happened in your father's situation?
Now that's a long story.
If there's a way to tell it briefly.
I'll start from the premise of how I put together Song for My Father. I entered art school at Emily Carr University. It wasn't a university then, it is now. But anyways, yeah, the integrated media program. And I began inquiring into the anti-psychiatry movement. And I saw that there was a basin there in storytelling, and began to recognize the value and empowerment in storytelling. And so I told my personal story in regard to how I felt about seeing my father essentially kidnapped by psychiatry and the psychiatric system and treatment, and how that took him away from me. Yet, we were able to, have a relationship throughout his lifetime. He passed away in 1998, and it was actually after that time that I began to have this urge, this dynamic urge to tell my story, and of course, it directly involved my experience of observing and witnessing his walk, walking the earth through this experience of psychiatry. And yet at the same time, he raised a family. So I found one thing quite interesting. I probably will go all over the map during my words in trying to explain this. It's such a huge kind of thing to fit into, one interview. But basically, I saw that his story related to so many other people's stories when I began to inquire into the anti-psychiatry movement. And my first introduction was when I met Irit Shimrat. And Irit actually directed me and, spoke of the networks of consumer movements, they call it ex-patient or survivor, anti-psychiatry movements, and activists. And through Irit's direction and our initial interview film together that we did called Insight, Insight, I began to see where I could fit a story together. So Song for My Father came after that. So it is political and a personal story about, it's a 15-minute film, and
How old were you when your father first started getting treated through psychiatry, and how long did that go on for?
Well, it was before I was born. In the 1950s, my father was first taken. He had an experience, an attack, or an altered state of consciousness, whatever you want to call it. And I'm going to say this word, and it's called phenomenological experience. So what happened was he was coming into harbor on a ferry, one of the BC ferries, and he jumped off the ferry. And so at that point, well, he was grabbed and taken to what was, it's Riverview now, what it was then was called Essendale. Basically, he was treated with insulin shock therapy, electroshock therapy, and neuroleptics. And so that was when he was about 23 years old, and I was born when he was about 27 years old. So basically that road, that door, that gate had opened well before I came into the world. And recently, Song for My Father was picked up by Ryerson University education and research on disability. David Revel is an instructor for a course there called A History of Madness. And he's been showing that film to point to personal and political experience around psychiatry and the movement. He's been showing it for about 3 years, and then it was picked up, and it's part of course material online right now. So what I wanted to say about that is, I forget what I wanted to say about that. What did I want? Sorry.
How does it make you feel that the film has been chosen, and that your story is being used as an example for how to talk about your personal experience with that?
Yeah, well, it's part of a legitimizing of the whole sort of basin and social attitudes around, you know, to deconstruct social attitudes around madness and legitimizing that language as a language that has value and represents a culture and a human experience. And a song for my father was a bit edgy, I felt. It was like on the fringe and on the edge of what is called normal. And but that it's now taken into an academic realm, and people are beginning to see it as an unfolding of experience and human experience, a social experience. It brings it into a legitimate kind of venue where there's a respectful observance and witness of it. And I remember now what I was going to say. Basically, I was there in Toronto in October of 2009, and I attended the class for a screening. David invited me to come, and so I did that. We screened the film, and one of the questions that I was asked was, what was it like growing up with a father who is schizophrenic? Or what was it like growing up with someone who's schizophrenic? And I said, well, you know, I don't know the answer to that because I grew up with my father. So that pretty much is how we experience people through relationship, not through pathologizing experience. And I see Arit here nodding her head and smiling.
Arit, yes, you were one of the pioneering folks in Canada to speak out about what was happening to psychiatric patients. I guess I'm just wondering, what was it like what was your own experience, and what was it like to have to come out and tell people about what was really going on within psychiatry?
My experience was that at the age of 20, a bunch of horrible things happened in my life, and I went nuts and got locked up and forced drugged and was locked up for many, many months. And my life fell apart entirely, and got out eventually, went off the drugs, and none of what had happened to me had been addressed at all by the people who were supposedly taking care of me. And I went bonkers again and got locked up for more than a year. And then I was psychiatry free for 18 years, during which time I found and became involved with the psychiatric survivors movement, or the MAD movement. I have always, it's always been easy for me to talk about it. And I think it's really important that this stuff does get talked about. There's so much promotion of so-called mental health care, and it's very important that the people who have been subjected to treatment that did us nothing but harm have a voice also to balance that.
Were there, at the time when you were going through the treatment, were there many people talking about it then? About the sort of negative effects of psychiatric treatment?
When I was first going through it, there were people talking about it, but I wasn't at all aware of that. I said that I was 18 years psychiatry free. I've been locked up a whole bunch of times since then, starting when I was 40, and I'm 52 now. And in this series of incarcerations and forced drugging, I was, of course, aware of the movement and, in fact, got lots of help from people I could communicate with who understood what I was going through. And although a bunch of crappy stuff happened to me, it made it a lot easier to know that I wasn't alone in thinking this was crappy stuff. And in fact, I incited some of my fellow patients to think about what was happening in a different way, and that helped me and helped them. And there's an organization called Mind Freedom, and they have a website which I highly recommend to anybody listening to this, called mindfreedom.org. And the director of that is called David Oakes, and he actually, I was able to get through to him on the phone when I was locked up in Comox in 2007. And he was extremely wonderful and helpful. And I feel that the movement helped me get through that time in a big way.
How much power do you have as a psychiatric patient to determine the kind of treatment that's given to you? Or how much power do you have over your situation at all?
If you're an involuntary patient, you don't have any. If you're there because you want to be, then depending on circumstances and your level of ability to communicate in a civil manner and who you happen to get for a doctor and for staff and so on, then you have a certain amount of power. But if you are bonkers and don't want to be there, you have none.
Mm-hmm. Cindy Lou, for your father, did he have much power over his own situation and the kind of treatment that he received?
I saw my father struggle definitely with gaining control over his life and his choices in freedom. And it, the incarcerations, this idea of people entering hospital. In psychiatry, when people go into hospital voluntarily, actually they can't just leave. If they're acting in such a way that it's disturbing others, family, and or social, the idea of how people should act. Then there's, if they begin to act in a way that's harmful to themselves or could be harmful to others, then they are arrested and locked up. And this happened with my father a number of times. I would see him being taken away. At that point, you don't have power. You are under the power of the authority. And then during the course of a few days, a few weeks, there's a review panel that you can request to advocate your release. And basically, you're under the discriminating eye of the medical experts who decide when you are well enough to be released back into your role in society, so-called. And so, there's an interesting story that I have there. My father, when I was driving him from my home where he had come to visit back to the downtown east side where he lived for many years, we went to the beach and we sat on a log there, and it was just at sunset. He sat quietly, very peaceful. My father loved nature, and he folded his hands and he looked out in the distance. And he said, you know, when there's a bunch of people sitting around and telling you one thing and another, he said, you just remember, he said, you're the perfect one. And I thought to myself, he must be talking about those review panels. But, so that's my experience there. And now I'm able to look back because there's a distance between those very tumultuous years and now. I'm able to look back and really come to terms with my own emotions and around everything that, you know, came up for me personally, politically. I was not really aware politically until about 10 years ago. I began to become more aware politically, which really empowered my my own orientation to myself and my experience and my father's experience. It really helped me to become active and give myself a voice and give this space, this silent space of suffering, a voice through the lens of the camera. And having the great privilege of witnessing so many people, so much strength and so much compassion in the work that these individuals are proliferating throughout systems. Tina Minkowitz, she's part of the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, and she works tireless, like, and she does not stop, and she works with ad hoc committees in developing language around human rights and treatment in psychiatry, and seeing electroshock therapy, for instance, as a torture. If you are imprisoned and someone is torturing you, that's a human rights issue. If you are taken by psychiatry and electroshocked, that is seen as medical treatment, and there's something wrong with that, you know. So, yeah.
Irit, Cindy Lou's just mentioned just this concept of, labeling electroshock therapy as torture when you are a psychiatric patient. As someone who's been an advocate for human rights for psychiatric patients for a long time, what sorts of changes are you looking for within the psychiatric system?
I personally have no hope whatsoever for the psychiatric system. The kind of change I'm looking for is the promotion and creation of alternatives to psychiatry, and that people should have a choice of... that people shouldn't automatically be thrown into a hospital when they go crazy, that there should be other places they can go, and that there should be things that can happen where they are, and that they can choose. Cindy mentioned that experts decide when you're well enough to be released from hospital, and I think that it's really important to mention that in the course of your being there, you are debilitated, you get institutionalized, you very quickly forget how to live in the outside world, you get drugged if you're unlucky, you get electroshocked as well, and often the primary criterion for release is compliance and submission. it's very much a matter of your spirit being broken. And so in the name of health and treatment and help, in fact, people are being debilitated, and the argument has been made, and I certainly am one of its proponents, that mental illness is a metaphor and not an actual disease entity. However, the treatments do cause actual diseases and disabilities and permanent disabilities, and people are taught to doubt themselves and to be dependent and to be weak, and that they are defective and that they need to be on psychiatric drugs for the rest of their lives. And there are conditions such as tardive dyskinesia is a primary one, which is a permanent neurological disorder that's caused by several of the psychiatric drugs. Many of them are in the category of neuroleptics that Cindy mentioned that her dad was on and that I was on and that most people are put on in psychiatric institutions and on psychiatric wards. Neuroleptics are also called phenothiazines or major tranquilizers, and they neuroleptic comes from the Latin for nerve seizing, and they actually work by impairing neurological function and by damaging the brain. And they have very, very serious effects, which are called side effects, but the word side can be tossed there. Yeah. And the other psychiatric drugs have all kinds of deleterious effects as well. I was put on a drug called Depakote, also called valproic acid, that is a supposed mood stabilizer used for mood disorders such as bipolar affective disorder, which was one of my recent diagnoses. And after 6 weeks on it, my thyroid function was permanently destroyed. And that, you know, it's a fairly serious thing, but relatively minor compared to all kinds of things that can happen to your body and your mind, never mind your self-esteem and your will to live under psychiatric treatment.
I guess one thing I'm thinking about is just the fact that there is, I think, a bit of a sense of confusion amongst the public about psychiatry, because, you know, on one sense we do hear stories like yours and, you know, the horror stories as they're portrayed in various Hollywood movies about what happens in psychiatric hospitals. But then also on the other end, we see folks in the Downtown East Side, and we're told, you know, people are there because of deinstitutionalization and the closing down of Riverview. And so I guess I'm just wondering, like, what should we be thinking about this, and what is the solution, if not, I don't know, deinstitutionalization, or just what your thoughts are.
Part of the solution are choices. Part of the solution is to empower people to not have their lives taken over by an authority. Assistance and bridging and recovery are popular terms now. There's kind of a breakthrough of and realization that people can gain control over their lives. If addictions come in to the mix, you know, that complicates, unfortunately, the ability for individuals to gain back their substantial instincts of being in the world and of relation to their mind and to the world. And so in that sense, it's so important to really be very aware of balance in one's own life and taking responsibility for how you feel, how you are, and and what you choose to do. Freedom in choice is our prerogative as human beings. You know, part of this idea of bringing and deconstructing psychiatry is about saying, you know, I'm allowed to make mistakes. I can make mistakes. It's okay because we learn from mistakes. And if I'm stuck in a mistake for 10 years, that's my prerogative, and it's my learning process. But to be shut down because, you know, you're causing a disturbance, a behavioral disturbance, is very much saying, you know, say as I do as I say, and this experience that you're having, we would rather that you be silent about it and just, you know, act normal. This normalizing of being in the world is really, it's not a human, I mean, it works in a very narrow view, but there's a broad spectrum of a human experience, and so, but our society wants to just stick within a very small spectrum of it, and that is just not the way it is. People are going to experience their full humanity, and so really taking back your power, taking back and owning experience is a huge part of taking back authorship of your life. And the moment we give our power over to another so-called expert, and then we're somehow usurping our own ability to see ourselves and how we can be peaceful and at peace and find serenity.
I don't think there is a lot of confusion among the public. I wish there was, about whether psychiatry is okay or not. I think most people think that it is legitimate and important. And the fact is that when people are behaving in a manner that is troublesome, and sometimes more than troublesome, and when I've been nuts, sometimes I have been a real bad pain to people who I love and who love me, and I don't know who they are, and I don't know who I am, and there's a feeling that something needs to be done. And the unfortunate thing is that the paradigm for what is to be done is monolithic. It's just psychiatry. It doesn't have to be. There have been experimental, and there are now, other ways of dealing with madness going on in little pockets here and there. It's very hard to popularize them because it's, you know, the drug industry, which is a huge, important part of capitalism, is underlies psychiatric treatment, and there's... people want to do what's easy and what they're used to, and there's a place in Germany called the Runaway House, where people, mostly people who've had psychiatric treatment themselves, look after, help people who don't want to go to the hospital or who have managed to get out of the hospital, and they have had very good success, and there have been other things like that. And in fact, many, many years ago, there was something in Vancouver. The Mental Patients Association still exists, but they used to run something called the Emotional Emergency Center, where people got help that wasn't psychiatric, and it works better. And one of the things that's not acknowledged is that people do have the capacity to go through horrific experiences and come out the other end. A friend of mine was just saying this to me the other night, and I was struck by the need to remember this, that the permanent disability of so-called mental illness is caused by the system and the people wandering around this part of town looking unfortunate and nutso, and who in fact have psychiatric diagnoses, are often debilitated by the drugs and by the system and by this experience of being invalidated and having their lives mangled. So I wish the public were confused and that there was more willingness to question and to look for and at other ways of dealing with difficult people.
Well, I wish we could talk about this more, but we are out of time. And I just want to thank you both so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Tiffany.
My guests have been Cindy Lou Griffith, a Vancouver filmmaker, and Arit Shimrat is a longtime activist in the anti-psychiatry movement. And she was interviewed for one of Cindy Lou's films. She's also written a book about her experiences with psychiatry called Call Me Crazy.